Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is John Avlon, who is a former CNN anchor who has thrown his hat into the ring to run for Congress in our district here in the Hamptons against the sitting Republican Nick LaLota. And John, I wanted to start off by asking you about a particular attack you've already gotten that you helicoptered in from Manhattan because you're a foreigner. And my understanding is he isn't even in the district.
Correct. Between Nick LaLota and myself, I'm the only one who can vote in this election. Nick LaLota isn't even his own congressman. I think he's the only member of Congress who has another representative representing him, Anthony Garbarino. So, you know, on that and many other levels, bring it on, Nick.
Let me ask you a couple of things along those lines. One would be, I'm presuming you have a place in Manhattan and you're in Sag Harbor as well. Yep. How do you like Sag Harbor? And how long have you been out coming out here? And why haven't I seen you before?
I've been reading your paper forever and ever. I love Sag Harbor. It is my heart. It is my soul. It is my home. It is the place I am happiest. I first started going out there. The first weekend my wife and I took away before we were married was in Sag Harbor, February of 07. It was freezing. And we started renting a house in the winters right after we were married in 09. And we wrote books there and ultimately bought one of the houses we rent and voted out there for years, partly because I recognized that, you know, out in Suffolk County, your vote counts. And yes. I was never a big fan of Lee Zeldin. And so, you know, this is just a community that speaks to my heart on every possible level.
What did you think you wanted to get into the fray, I guess we'll call it?
Look, it's part of a long debate. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people I talk to say, you know, are you all right? Are you? Why would you do this? And I think that's part of the reason our announcement got a big pickup is I think we're used to people in Congress who want to be on TV and be on cable news. I think we're less used to folks leaving, you know, TV and cable news to enter the fray for public service. But look, I'm the grandson of immigrants. And as a result, I grew up very patriotic. I think a lot of immigrant families do, not only immigrant families, but a real special sense that America means something to the world, that it's that this is a place that can't be taken for granted. We can't take our democracy for granted. And I've covered two Trump cycles, one as editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast. In 2016, when we were blacklisted by his campaign early out of the gate, which I wear as a badge of honor. And then in 2020, as a senior political analyst and anchor at CNN, doing a daily segment on the morning show called Reality Check. And I genuinely didn't think Republicans would renominate Donald Trump after he tried to overturn an election on the back of a lie. I was like, no way. I mean, they wouldn't have renominated Bush 41, right? Surely that's too much. And yet they did. That was a moment of, when we could see it coming, my wife and I started speaking about the seriousness of the moment. I didn't feel like I could, as much as I love my job and my former colleagues, and I've loved being a journalist. And there is a tradition of a lost tradition of journalists centering public service. I didn't feel like I could simply stomach offering opinions on cable news. I think something more. I wanted to not just talk, I wanted to do. And I looked at the district we live in and realized as a first-term Republican, Nick LaLota, who is far too far right for the district, But we needed a competitive candidate who could kind of energize the race, get in and make a difference and win the seat. And yeah. I thought that was something I could do. That was some positive good I could do when it mattered most. And, you know, I didn't want to look at my kids and say I could have done more when it mattered most. And that's what I feel about this election. So that's why I made the leap. I made the jump into the arena.
Well, congratulations. You know, once Trump was elected, I went back and began reading about all the old presidents and their biographies. And people have been back and forth at each other's throats on one side or another, going back to Hamilton and Burr, you know, and it's just what's done. Although now it's on steroids, you know, because of TikTok and Wiki and crazy.
Sure. Well, social media makes it worse.
It's sort of, I think it's kind of doubled over since, we'll call it the draw, I call it, where back in 2000, Gore and Bush fought to a draw. And since that time, it's been exactly a draw going now 22, 23 years.
Well, but I'll press that point. Look, I mean, I write history books on the side. I've written not just history books, but a book called Wing Nuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America.
Yes.
In 14 years ago now. I was covering the extremist beat and the lurch of the Republican Party to the far right and would draw parallels to history. And sometimes there are parallels. But I would argue that the position we're in now, and my most recent books have been about George Washington's farewell address and a book called Lincoln and the Fight for Peace, about his plan to win the peace after winning the war. I believe deeply in applied history, right? We're looking for useful wisdom that we can apply to our own time.
Yes.
And that's one of the things I'm most passionate about. It's one of the reasons I think we desperately need investment in civic education again. But what we're dealing with now is meaningfully different, right? We have had times where our country has felt fractured before. We should recognize by now the dangers of tribal politics, of hyperpartisanship, of polarization. Washington warned against that in the farewell address. What's different is that we've never had a major party nominee campaign on an authoritarian platform, praising dictators at every campaign stop, who already tried to overturn an election to stay in power on the back of a lie. That's nothing like that in our history. And so I think we need to be really clear-eyed. And instead, I think the danger is that folks are tuning out politics and the news and civics at exactly the wrong time. It's what Liz Cheney calls sleepwalking towards dictatorship. And I think we need to be wide awake in America right now. We need to shake things up and take a sense of agency back as citizens, because it's ultimately up to us. And that's what I'm fired up about. I think it's a mistake to say, well, it's always been bad. Jefferson and Adams said bad things about each other. Yeah, but they lived to regret it. You know, we need to learn the lessons for how we've been able to heal after our divided times and not give in to this stuff, because it's incredibly dangerous. The trajectory of the 21st century, Dan, will be fundamentally different and at home and abroad. And this is where President Biden's right. Defining struggle of our time is democracy versus autocracy. And Democrats can't afford to lose this fight, not nationally and certainly not here in the first district. Guess what? If we win in the first district, we win here in Suffolk County.
Yeah.
We'll win Congress. We'll win Congress. So it's about something bigger than us. It's about we have the opportunity and I think the obligation to win.
Do you have any thoughts locally about things that need to be done and fixed?
Oh, my God. As I talk to folks, I mean, you know, from Huntington out to Montauk, talk to Democrats, obviously, we've got to stop Donald Trump. Second thing is always, always affordability. You know, average cost of a house is over $600,000. Families who've been here for generations are feeling priced out. People can't work near where they live, which compounds the transportation problems. And I think there are a couple of concrete things we can do to improve the quality of life, but lower the cost of living. First thing is salt. Here's the deal. Donald Trump and Republicans raised our taxes, and they did it out of spite as part of a political stunt. You know, if you got a family in Smithtown makes $185,000, let's say he's a plumber, she's a teacher, got two kids, they would get $3,800 back if the SALT deduction was put back in place before it was taken away. Add that expanding the child tax credit. You know, that's another around $3,000. That's real money for working families. That makes a real difference in their quality of life, making a difference. But there are other things, obviously, government can do. I think we need to be focused like a laser beam on strengthening the middle class. But look at transportation, look at housing. A relatively small investment through the MTA budget, aided by the federal government, around $250 million over 10 years. And Fred Thiel's put, I was honored to get Fred's support this past week, by the way, deeply honored because he's such a legend. But he's put forward a proposal that I utterly support, and I think we can augment in Congress, adding rail sidings so that, you know, we get more trains coming out on the South Fork. It would be transformative for reducing traffic and improving access. And Suffolk County's poised to benefit from the changing nature of work, but we got to fix transportation. We got to fix our digital infrastructure, broadband and cell phone service, and then housing. There's a really cool proposal that's starting to be put in place in Minnesota where they're repurposing an old mall and making it into basically adding, like, you know, two or three story housing.
Yes.
And all of a sudden you repurpose that space with a good transportation sewer. It doesn't destroy the historic culture of the communities, but it takes advantage of an underutilized space where it's already set up to be sort of a pop-up new community with affordable housing in a way that actually fits the workers and temporary workers and starter housing for folks. So things like that are exciting, but I think that's also what we got to do. We got to be excited about solving problems again, make people feel the government can work again. And I don't mind being sort of a policy wonk. You just got to communicate it in a way that folks can understand.
Yes, I agree with practically everything you've had to say. Let me ask you about your background. Where'd you grow up, and what was your schooling, and what got you interested in this whole thing in the first place about such a large thing to be working on, international.
I appreciate that. I mean, the other way to ask that is, what made you such a damn fool to think you'd get involved in this? I was born in New York City. My mother's from Youngstown, Ohio, immigrant family. Grandfather came through Ellis Island via Argentina. And their family had fled the Balkan Wars. And he served in World War II. His father worked in the steel mills. And he came back and raised five kids and became a doctor. She met my dad. His father was a stowaway on a ship after his whole family was wiped out in the Spanish influenza epidemic. He was orphaned in the Spanish influenza epidemic. Met my grandmother in New York, who's the only non-immigrant part of the family. He grew up in New York, in Greenwich Village. So I was born here in 1973. They moved out of New York when I was 14. I went to college at Yale. And came back immediately. I'd gotten first excited about politics. Well, two ways. My grandfather always told stories about Abraham Lincoln and Harry Truman. You know, he was really, you know, a patriot. And they were like living presences in our home. And that to me was that sort of civic religion that I love, where, you know, as I've written many times, you know, America is the first country in the world founded on an idea, not a tribal identity. And I think that makes us, we need unifying stories to survive, and tribal politics short circuits our culture, especially because of those two things. So I was always excited by
what's tribal history. Policy? What's tribal policy?
Tribal politics is when people define their political identity based upon their racial, ethnic, or regional identity. It's tribalism, right? It's what in part led to the Civil War. It short circuits our best self in a unique way in a country like ours. So I think that was the roots of it. I double majored in political science and American studies, American literature. My writing have always involved history even as a columnist, which I've been a columnist for most of my life, as well as an editor in chief, but I always like, and I did this on CNN as well. I'd always try to bring in history because I think history imposes perspective on problems. And I think it's interesting. So for me, it's not just, you know, there is this lost tradition like Teddy Roosevelt. New York and Long Island's own Teddy Roosevelt of journalists getting in. But also when I was in college, that was the Clinton campaigns. And I really got excited and volunteered on Bill Clinton's 92 campaign. Was an intern in his White House one summer and then worked on volunteered on the 96 campaign when Judith Hope was running things. And that was formative for me. That sort of DLC third way politics, the, you know, Bill Clinton, Tony Blair approach, opportunity, responsibility, community. Always made a lot of sense to me, and it worked out politically. Democrats had lost three elections by more than 40 states. Wasn't true after Bill Clinton. And so that was really animating for me, just foundationally. You know, that raises one other thing that you mentioned about how, well, we've always been at our throats. And, you know, Harry Truman used to say, there's nothing new in the world but the history you don't know. My kids hear me quote that all the time. They're 10 and 8. But, I, you know, one thing that's different is that Republicans have only won the popular vote once since 1988.
Oh my God, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that's different.
Wasn't it by like 6 votes? What are you thinking about?
The one time they won the popular vote was 2004. George W. Bush, he won Ohio. And that swung the popular vote as well as the electoral into his column. But, you know, this is something you got to keep our eyes on. I mean, in 2000, you know, the thing is, when I talk to really progressive activists who are very concerned about all the ways that our society needs to really lean in and heal breaches and deal with climate change and healthcare and all that, there is a core strain of pragmatism. If they understand that, you know, it doesn't matter if you don't win. And one of the great object lessons of that is, and I can't get over the stat, 98,000 people in Florida in 2000 thought that Al Gore wasn't good enough on the environment. So they voted for Ralph Nader on the green ticket.
Right, right.
George W. Bush wins the state by 537 votes. And we pull out of the Kyoto Climate Accords. careful what you wish for. And I just think there's fundamentally strength to that broad center-left position. It's between the head and the heart.
But then you have the whole collapse of the collegiality of Congress, and back in the day, even reading some of Carroll's books on Johnson, you get
I love those books.
People all work together, and it all started come undone. And my view of it was always it just got worse and worse. It's like we can get a one thing here and one thing there, but then they get something, and there's a lot of work to do here.
Of course, there's a lot of work to do, but it's our country and it's up to us to do the work, right? That's the whole point. You know, we're citizens, not subjects.
Right.
That's why I'm doing this, because I think it's darkest before the dawn. People thought that Long Island was going inexorably Republican, and then Tom Suozzi proved that candidate selection and issues matter and nothing's inevitable. You just got to play offense.
Yeah.
You mentioned Bob Caro, who obviously I revere as a reader and a writer. And a historian. And of course, he's New York's own, lives out on the East End as well as in New York City. You know, there were structural things that were in place that made Congress work better then. There were conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. That was part of it. But Newt Gingrich coming in, and he sort of gutted a lot of the incentive structures that allowed folks to work together and get to know each other. Families knew each other. People knew each other. It's more difficult to demonize people when you know them. Which is one of the reasons why political leaders need to reach out and talk to folks, not just play to the base. I think that's the fundamental sin. But structurally, we've gotten worse, in part because there are fewer and fewer swing seats. And the parties like it, and people like having safe partisan, safe, you know, general elections. But it's bad for democracy. And that's one of the reasons I think we have a rare opportunity here in the first district on Suffolk County, because it's a genuine swing district. Tim Bishop held it brilliantly for 12 years, been held by Republicans for a decade. But this is a swing district, and too often I've been frustrated that it hasn't always been seen or treated that way. But it is, and I think we need more swing districts. That would be healthy for our politics, be healthy for our country.
Do you have any opinions about the various wars going on?
Well, I think you got to take a big. Here's where I think we need perspective. We need perspective in pretty much everything. But I do think Joe Biden's right. As I said, the defining struggle of our time is autocracy versus democracy.
Yes.
I think you need to look at almost everything through that prism. Right now, we are carrying that out at home and abroad. We see autocratic countries trying to influence elections in other countries where many of the same issues are coming up. Democracies like France, you know, I mean, we see the fight against disinformation. You know, we've seen foreign attempts to influence our elections and meddle in our elections, including in 2022, in a congressional report that was not widely picked up. So I think we need to be wide awake. Ukraine, I strongly favor support for Ukraine. I think anyone opposing it right now is the Neville Chamberlains of our time. And I think it's particularly, Nikola Lota has been silent on the subject. What, presumably because Donald Trump doesn't want it, because he always, you know, to me, that one of the whole, you know, he mocked James Lankford for doing the bipartisan border security bill. Why? Well, because it's his personality, but also because, you know, these folks don't believe bipartisanship's the solution. They believe it's the problem. Well, they couldn't be more wrong. They want to fundraise and fear monger, but they don't want to fix it. That's a firing offense. But so Ukraine is an outrage. Israel, look, I mean, October 7th was a horrific terrorist attack. I lived through 9/11 up close. It's one of the defining moments in my life. Many of us did. It defined the life of our community for many families. And you know what? I think you stand with victims of terrorism. You don't blame victims of terrorism. Ultimately, of course, you need to be mindful that the civilian casualties don't cause people to buy in to that myth of moral relativism. Israel is a great ally of the United States historically, and we need to remember, and it needs to be again, that there's broad bipartisan support for Israel. And I think the Netanyahu policies have made that more difficult. I'm more of a Benny Gantz, Yair Lapid kind of guy. I'm a centrist in that respect. But I think ultimately you need a two-state solution with a demilitarized Palestinian state. But, you know, Hamas leadership, you know, I'm sorry, they started this. And they, not the civilians, should be the ones to suffer the brunt and the reaction force.
Let's talk about something a little more fun. About how do you spend time in Sag Harbor? How do you enjoy yourself and your family?
Look, what? I mean, my God, I mean, where to begin? In the summers, I love going to Whalers games with my kids. I love going to the beach, Long Beach, as well as the Atlantic. When they were really little, it was easier to go to Long Beach because the waves were smaller. The sheer quality of it's the community about Sag Harbor. I mean, again, we started, you know, before we lived here full time, you know, we came out in the winter because it's what we could afford. But it's the community, the quality, the humans, the writers. I'm a writer, obviously, painters. It's the big sky that I find so inspiring. It's the sense of scale. It's a human scale.
Yeah,
filled with the most fascinating people. So if you go into the American Hotel on any night, you're going to run into some people you've admired as well as friends. I love driving out to Montauk, one of the most beautiful drives in the world, particularly at sunset. Go down to, you know, get dinner out there. Just hanging out with friends. There's nothing I don't love about it. The other day I looked up and there's a bald eagle in the tree behind our house.
Oh my.
I mean, we organize the day around sunset, no matter what time of year, because it's, as long as it's clear, it's soul stirring. I think it's the most beautiful. I think East End of Long Island is the most beautiful place in America.
Do you have a view of sunset where you live?
We don't exactly. So I get the reflection of sunset. We're off a cove in Sag Harbor. But then if you go around the corner, the John Steinbeck House, which I had a role in helping to save with other members of the community. I'm big on saving literary history, but that was a great way the community rallied together. Catherine Stroka at Canio's was instrumental, but we both, now it's a writer's retreat run by the Michener Center. There's a great sunset, that view. Of course, Long Beach has a great sunset. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I go down to the drum circles and catch a good sunset. You know, it's just, what's not to love? It's got the biggest sky anywhere on the East Coast. It's a magic place.
I agree with you. And that's why I stayed. I came out as a teenager in the 50s.
Wow.
And it was just so much more rural then, but the great beauty has survived thanks to things like the real estate tax and these
farms. Community preservation funds.
Well, yeah. Klein and all the people that did all these great things. And I started in Montauk, and back then it was all up for grabs. Now 3/4 of Montauk, which is so gorgeous, is saved, various parks and things.
I mean, one more reason to praise Fred Thiel. I mean, you know, 35 years of service, you know, first as a Republican, then an independent, then a Democrat, you know, his principles and his effectiveness never changed. And see those CPF funds, which helped secure Steinbeck's house, but have done so much more.
Yeah.
What a successful example about how government can work. And I was talking to John Halsey about the Peconic Land Trust and the enormous legacy that is for the entire community.
Yeah.
And the good ideas that can come from that. I mean, the work of Tim Bishop, FIP, which brought the Army Corps of Engineers to help rebuild the beach just recently out in Montauk, and I think can be part of the solution. There's so many folks like yourself who are just local legends who've dramatically improved the quality of life and preserved the quality of life. So thank you for that.
And thank you for being on the podcast. They last 20 minutes, people, as we used to say, turn the dial.
There's no dial.
No dial, yeah. And God bless you for running for this. And I
thank you.
Hope all the best for you. Thanks again.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate you. It's great talking to you. I look forward to talking to you anytime.
Okay. Bye-bye.